Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point.
Ready!
Marine Corporal Charles O. Palmer II, age 36, was buried in Manteca, California on May 16th, one of the now 3,433 U.S. war dead in Iraq. At the funeral, his brother Jason spoke to family and friends.
What a load he was carrying the day he died. Because he was carrying a load for each and every one of us. Just so that we can stand here and be free in this country.
Across the country, on this weekend, the dead of many wars will be honored. But this Memorial Day comes at a hard time in the Iraq War, a time when the dying goes on, but outcomes are so unclear, and the war itself is questioned so deeply. This hour on Point, honor, remembrance, and the meaning of soldiers' sacrifice in a troubled war. Joining me today from Nashville is Jean Bethke Elfstein. She's professor of social and political ethics at the University of Chicago's Divinity School. She's a contributing editor to The New Republic and author most recently of Just War Against Terror, The Burden of American Power in a Violent World. Jean Bethke Elfstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us from New York is Jonathan Schell, peace and disarmament correspondent for The Nation magazine and a visiting professor of international relations at Yale University. He covered the Vietnam War for The New Yorker, where he worked for 20 years. He's author of The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. Jonathan Schell, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Good to be with you.
Jonathan, first to you. Here we are coming up on this Memorial Day, and we all see the headlines. They come in every day, another four, another five, another six U.S. soldiers dead in a war that has become so kind of ambiguous. The president has a hard time describing what an endpoint might be. Disillusionment is great in many quarters. The latest polls show Republicans and Democrats disillusioned. This is clearly a troubled war. How then do we think about the sacrifices, Jonathan, that these soldiers are making?
Well, I think the question is a deep one. Nations are in a very real sense founded on sacrifice. All you have to do is think of the Declaration of Independence with its pledge to sacrifice our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, or the Gettysburg Address, you know, which speaks of soldiers who gave their lives that the nation might live. So we're dealing here with incredibly powerful and elemental sentiments that really reach way beyond the rational, really ones at the very heart of myths that nations live by. And by myths, I don't mean illusions. I mean the faith that that sustains a nation. So when a war is misconceived or wrong or felt that way by the public, it goes very, very deep. It wreaks havoc with this whole framework of faith, going far beyond the war in question to really these national myths and sentiments, which are so primal and elemental.
Jean, in Nashville, how do you think about it? Here we are. You know, with all the trouble that this war represents, and yet, unlike Vietnam, the country's been very solid in its in voicing its support for the troops, and yet the more ambiguous the war's kind of schema and outcome becomes, the harder it is to understand exactly what they're dying for. We heard that Jason, the brother of Charles Palmer, the Marine who died in Iraq, saying, you know, they died so we could stand here and be free in this country.
Bearing the burden of freedom.
Is that sufficient? Is that a sufficient explanation to give at this point with this war to give meaning to these sacrifices?
Well, I think it undoubtedly suffices for many of those who've lost loved ones. That it does speak to what Jonathan alluded to, these very powerful, and I think he called them elemental sentiments. It's important to remember, I think, that Iraq is not the first unpopular war in our history, obviously. Thinking back to the Korean War, it was a tremendously unpopular war. Truman's approval ratings were in the tank. And yet, looking back, we remember those veterans who had a very hard time, the soldiers did, and the sacrifices of those who died in a way that I think is entirely appropriate, whatever the popularity of the war at the time. As well, the nation, looking back on the treatment of many of the Vietnam vets when they returned from the war, looks back on that with a sense of some regret, I think, even a sense of shame, that somehow the soldiers were made to bear the burden, entire burden, of what had become an unpopular war. It's not so easy to separate out the issue of whether you favor the war or not from the question of the sacrifice of soldiers. And yet I think that's what the vast majority of Americans are at this point doing.
Though, Jonathan, it may not even be about whether or not one supports the war. Even for supporters, somehow the war's purpose has become cloudy. It's not clear where it's going to end up. It's not exactly the liberation of this or that. We've got a sectarian struggle going on. So never mind the popularity. What about the soldier in the field or a soldier watching a fellow soldier lie dying? How should they, how can they understand the meaning of that very, very real sacrifice?
Yeah, well, I think to a certain extent, as Gene suggests, the soldiers can, and I think most people at home do as well, including those who oppose the war. They do draw a line of separation between the rightness or wrongness of the war and the meaning of the sacrifice. But it honestly only carries you so far, because if the war's purpose is wrong or if the war is misbegotten, then a sort of terrible specter is raised of the possibility of a meaningless sacrifice, at least in the cause at hand. And at the same time, it raises the question, the moral question, of the wrongless death, of pointless killing of other people. So it would be a wasted sacrifice and also wrongful death. Of course, I think that soldiers, when they sign up to serve, they don't sign up for a particular war. And I think all of us feel, including those like myself who have been opposed to the war, that was not their decision to go into this particular war, so that they don't have that burden of responsibility. That rests clearly on the civilian leaders. But since in our national sentiments or in our mythology, maybe in reality, you know, we have these deep and primal feelings that perhaps the very existence of the nation rests on this willingness to sacrifice, it puts an extra burden, I would say, on the civilian leaders, and thank God they are civilians and that we have that civilian control over the military, puts an extra burden on them not to make this kind of horrendous mistake, which really becomes an abuse of this readiness to sacrifice that everyone seems to value.
Gene, there was a sense with the all-volunteer army that we have now that perhaps the public would care a bit less somehow than when these were the drafted sons of everybody going in. In fact, I have the sense, and I think you share it, that people have a kind of feeling of guilt and care more that these be justifiable sacrifices, even of those who volunteered.
It is a rather extraordinary thing. I was one of those who fretted at the time of the move to the all-volunteer force that the vast majority of young people not being implicated, the public would perhaps lose sight of the harm's way into which we put soldiers. But there's been an increased reluctance to take casualties. We've seen that in our recent history, I think. We could see that in Kosovo when President Clinton wanted an intervention that would involve no American combat casualties whatsoever, a zero casualty war for our combatants. This is an interesting cultural transformation. I don't think we understand it fully, but it's certainly there. And there's something about The fact that these young men and women have, in fact, stepped up to the plate and volunteered, that gives a kind of added dimension to the solemnity, if you will, of sending them into harm's way. Jonathan and I are not in full agreement about how misbegotten the Iraq War is or was, but I think we would agree on that part of it. Let me add one other thing quickly, and that is that many of our images of how wars are to end remain sort of stuck with visions of surrenders and dramatic moments when victory gets
declared. The deck of the aircraft carrier, as President Bush said, do not expect this time.
Do not expect that. That's not the way wars are going. That's not the way wars are going to go in the future. It seems to me they're going to end often very ambiguously, the way Korea certainly ended, with a truce.
We're talking this hour about Iraq, Memorial Day, and the sacrifice of soldiers, the meaning of soldiers' sacrifice in a troubled war. First Lieutenant Andrew J. Basevich, 27, of Walpole, Massachusetts, died May 13th, Mother's Day, in Balad, Iraq. He died of wounds suffered after an explosion. He was the son of Andrew Basevich, professor at Boston University, former Army colonel, Vietnam veteran. His funeral was just a few days ago. Family friend Colonel Barry Price described Lieutenant Andrew J. Basevich and his gift.
Based on my dialogue with Andy and his final email, I saw in Andy all the traits that we desire in the next generation: value laden, strength of character, compassion, commitment, leadership, vision versus sight. And I also clearly saw in Andy the hallmark that has defined every member of this bereaved family: service to others.
Service to others. But service for what? For what exactly in this war? Right now, from Boulder Junction, Wisconsin, we're joined by Richard Cohn, military historian, professor of history and peace, war and defense at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, currently on leave as professor of strategic leadership at the U.S. Army War College and Dickinson College, author of Eagle and Sword. Richard Cohn, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Give us some historical context here. This is not the first time that the United States has fought a difficult war or an unpopular war, and yet this one goes on. It's called a debacle. It's called a disaster by critics, and we see the death toll every day. So how do you look at the meaning of these soldiers' sacrifice in this kind of situation?
Well, as Gene suggests, this is not the first time, and as you do too, Tom, but wars are contested with domestic opposition in different ways at different times. This one has its own special characteristics and its own parallels with Vietnam and Korea. I think of it, somberly and sadly. It seems to me that the meaning of the sacrifice is that these people die for all of us. Whether the war is considered wisely or unwisely, a miscalculation or not, it is the policy of the U.S. government. It's been supported by both of the political branches of the government, and those youngsters go over there, and some are not so young. Many are National Guard reserves. They serve and they sacrifice, and I would make one last point, too, is that there are others who are sacrificing, and we must remember them, and that's the families of these people who die in the war. That tragedy and that sadness, brokenheartedness, goes on for many people the rest of their lives. The dead are gone, but it lasts for them, and collectively, I think, for the nation as a whole, permanently. That's why we have memorials. We have commemorations like Memorial Day.
I want to probe a little more deeply. You say, ultimately, we see their sacrifice as this: they die for all of us. And yes, that must be true. I mean, we read them also saying they die for the comrade to their right and to their left. But we want to go deeper after all these years of this war. I mean, here's a war where you have Lieutenant General William Odom calls it the greatest strategic disaster in U.S. history. You've got the former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Zabrinsky calling it a historic, strategic, and moral calamity. You've got Republican Senator Gordon Smith in the Senate just at the end of last year calling it absurd, maybe even criminal. in that circumstance, Richard Cohn, it's not just opposition; it's a critique of the qualities of the war itself on the table here.
That kind of critique, Tom, has been present in previous American wars, and sometimes it's been considerably more bitter and considerably more emotional and considerably more rational than what you've just read. In the Civil War, huge numbers of Americans in the North and in the South disagreed bitterly with the policy of their region. In World War I, much of the political leadership was against going into the war from the very beginning. One of the problems we have in this country, it seems to me, is the belief that World War II is the standard, that in fact is the way war should be thought, should be fought.
The good war with the glorious dead, the gleaming rows of white crosses that we almost stand proud of.
Unity and so on, and that's just not the case. And the political leadership is often very deeply and bitterly divided. During the Vietnam War, two Democratic senators, Fulbright of Arkansas and Stennis of Mississippi, had hearings very much opposed to the way the Johnson administration was fighting the war, and tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of Americans were in the street. And so this war is different, but it's not, in my judgment as an historian, worse or better than others.
I want to be sure I understand. You say this war is not worse or better than others in strategic...
In terms of the opposition and the divisions.
But in terms of the worthiness of the war itself, in the interest of which these young men and women are dying?
Well, there you ask me a political judgment of my own, and I think it's an enormous strategic miscalculation, compounded many times over by the bungling of it by our government. And it's also not one war. It began as a war to overthrow Iraq. It changed into an insurgency against American occupation, and now it's changed again in the last year to 2 years into a sectarian civil war that's suppressed by, to some degree, by our presence. But you asked me my judgment about it. I might have had a similar judgment of other wars.
You know, Jonathan Schell, so there it is. We have big critiques of this war. Richard Cohn reminds us, and it's valuable to know, that many wars have been bitterly critiqued as they've gone on. But this is in our time. This is one we're watching. We've had major political figures, including John McCain and Senator Obama, both use the word wasted for lives lost here. Senator McCain saying when he announced his run for the presidency, we've wasted a lot of our most precious treasure, which is American lives. Barack Obama saying over 3,000 lives of the bravest young Americans wasted. Now, they both backtracked on that word very quickly, but they used it right there in public, and these men are not fools.
Well, in my opinion, they were right to use it in the sense that I think the war was misconceived just from the very beginning, and in that sense, those lives were decidedly wasted. That does not, however, take away the value of the sacrifice that was made. In fact, it rather highlights it in a certain sense, because it's as if it appears almost in a greater purity, in the sense that these are people who have died not for the particular cause at hand, in which case we might say the life was wasted, but maybe for the country as a whole, this sort of abstract readiness to sacrifice that, you know, goes back to those texts that I was mentioning earlier in the Declaration of Independence and so forth.
We have a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Let me turn to Rachel in Sumter, South Carolina. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
My husband is currently about a month and a half into a one-year deployment to Afghanistan, mm-hmm. For which he volunteered. Mm-hmm. And I just have to say that when I found out he was going to be going to Afghanistan instead of Iraq, it was a great relief to me.
Because?
Not just from a safety perspective, but also because if I lost my husband in Iraq, I don't know if I could deal with it. I have so little support for that conflict and so little confidence in its outcome and so little confidence in what may or may not be accomplished there. I don't mean by any means to diminish the efforts of our troops there. I support them all 100%. It's the people who put them there that I have a problem with.
But Rachel, now, you must live in a military community or associate with one. Do you feel alone in this perspective? Are there others who feel the same?
I feel quite alone in this perspective, yeah. But unfortunately, it amazes me and disgusts me how little conversation there is in my community about our military involvement there or anywhere or anything. I mean, so I was glad to find out he was going to Afghanistan because although I believe there were some nefarious reasons mixed in with, you know, trying to catch Osama bin Laden that sent us there, there has been a great deal accomplished there. And my husband wanted to go there and do what he can he's a power production guy. He's helping to rebuild infrastructure.
Yeah.
He's working as a military advisor, a mentor for Afghan National Army NCOs, trying to help them, you know, establish a more modern military system.
Right.
And he was glad to go there and do that. I miss him terribly. I will see him one time for 2 weeks before May of next year.
But you're glad he's there and not in Iraq. Rachel, we wish him all the best of luck during his deployment there. And thank you for calling. Jean Bethke Elstein,
yes.
Here's the wife of a soldier serving, saying thank heavens he's gone to Afghanistan and not Iraq, because in her judgment, in Iraq, she would not have known what to make of the sacrifice if it came.
Well, that makes the whole thing, of course, enormously, enormously difficult. But I think even had that been done, she could have taken some comfort in the fact that the commitment that her husband has demonstrated and the theme of service to others, which has been evoked over the course of our discussion, is actually much higher, more ongoingly displayed among our military people than in other cohorts in our society. And I think that's another reason for why we honor the sacrifice, because we know they didn't have to do this. And we fret, I think, for good reason, about how inward-turning, individualistic, materialistic, many are in our own society. And here is a contrast, a very powerful contrast to that, you know, a strong sense of commitment and service to others. And I think that needs to be taken into account as we think about our soldiers with Memorial Day coming up.
But Jonathan Schell suggests that in some sense it may even be more noble, more admirable when it's when the cause is vague. But really, is they say, this is a soldier saying, while you figure it out, dear country, I'm standing up and prepared to die. But that seems a very wrong thing to ask.
But soldiers have often done that, as Richard pointed out. There's often been great ambiguity, and war aims change over the course of a war. It doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is simply confused. It means that as wars unfold, developments alter, and you may wind up fighting additionally for example, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, there's no doubt that they're powerful and that they've been enhanced by foreign jihadists coming in. Now, many would say, and it would be a very powerful argument, that that's another of the mistakes made, because we sort of opened the pathway for this sort of thing to happen. But there's no doubt that that's now happening. So the war aims change. And I think that's been true of many of our wars. So soldiers, the great Prussian theorist of war, von Clausewitz, talked about the famous fog of war. Well, there's also a fog of politics. You know, things are often very conflicted, very ambiguous, and we don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. That's more the norm than absolute clarity,
whether it's
in matters of war or anything else.
But there seems to me a point at which, as a fellow citizen to these soldiers, I've got a responsibility and a load of guilt when it gets just as foggy as it is in this one. Let me go to Julie in Old Forge, New York. Yeah. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a note that, you know, this weekend is just an amazing thing for all those who have loved ones in the military, past, present, future, serving overseas in Afghanistan and Iraq and all over the world.
Have you served? Has your family, Julie?
My husband, yeah.
Did he come home safe?
Yes, he did. He served both in Afghanistan and Iraq. But
why are you crying?
It's just emotional, you know. We can't forget the soldiers who come home, maybe physically, in one piece, but otherwise, they aren't. You know, my husband's a different person now than he was before he left, and we just have to remember that the war leaves so many scars that go unnoticed and untalked about and unheard of. And, you know, when it comes down to whether or not their sacrifice is legitimate, we have to remember that the soldier is performing his duty. He signed on to do that, and it is his honor to serve his country in any way, shape, or form. Mm.
But the price can be steep.
I am not a war supporter. But I do support our troops and my husband just phenomenally.
Julie, you remind us of the sacrifice of the living in these wars as well. We're talking this hour about Iraq, Memorial Day, and the sacrifice of soldiers, looking at the meaning of soldiers' sacrifice in a troubled war. Richard Cohn, to say, and it's well to be reminded by our caller, that it is not only those who die who sacrifice in all wars, in this war.
That's absolutely true, Tom, and I think the sacrifice, as I said before, to their families, but I'd make a larger point, might be a little controversial. I think no matter what kind of war it is, it damages all of us who are involved in it. The tragedy of it, the sadness, the sacrifice. Those of us who study it are damaged, I think, in some ways. We become more callous, more distant. The war is a ubiquitous human phenomenon as we know it, but it has some very negative aspects. Sure, it has some positive. It brings out sacrifice and loyalty and discipline and honor, etc., but it also has negatives for all of us, I think.
Jonathan Schell, I wonder if you think, I mean, this is interesting. After the Vietnam War, there was guilt among many war opponents about having been tough on veterans. This time, soldiers have been embraced by just about everyone. But I wonder if that in some way cuts us off from making tougher judgments, from standing up more vigorously. Does it lead to accepting their sacrifices, whether or not they seem to be accomplishing stated goals, or whether or not there even are achievable goals?
Yeah, well, that's a real riddle. One point that may bear on it, I think, is that when a war is misconceived or just wrong, which I think is the case in Iraq, it's not just an abstract matter as if some goals had been gotten wrong. It affects the lived experience of the war. Certainly, I saw that when I was a reporter in Vietnam, because the soldiers there, of course, were told that they were there to help the South Vietnamese population and people and so on. So they were startled and amazed and surprised when those same people would lay booby traps in the paths or throw hand grenades at them and so forth, because really the American presence there was deeply unpopular, and it was based on misconceptions born out of Washington. And of course, what that resulted in was an untenable and horrible position for the soldiers. And one consequence was the, you know, very high incidence of atrocity in Vietnam. And I think we see that developing in Iraq as well, where you have a similar misconception from the very beginning of the war, that the soldiers therefore have to live out a sort of disjunction between what they've been told and what it is they're trying to do and the realities on the ground.
We spoke with Larry Heineman, Vietnam veteran, winner of the National Book Award, wrote Paco's story, has written a lot about military life since his own service. He said to us, as a former soldier, my heart goes out to the guys who are stuck pounding ground both in Iraq and Afghanistan. It makes my heart sore, this thankless work. It cannot be easy doing the unnecessary for the ungrateful. The country likes to think of itself as grateful, but there's one former soldier not sure that the gratitude is up to the sacrifice. Let's go to Melita, calling from Boston. Hi, Melita, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm. My stepson, Alexander, was killed in Iraq during his second deployment. He was a U.S. Marine. And one of the things that he noticed after he returned from his first tour of duty was that as his comrades fell, no one would lower the flags half-mast. And that was something that made his father, my husband, and I, it's something that resonated with us after he died.
You mean at the post office, at the school, back home, you mean?
Exactly. And especially when, after our grieving and in the course of our grieving, it came home to us how disrespectful it is to the troops and to those who have fallen to not be allowed to see those caskets come off the plane, to have them go into, come in overnight so that people don't see them.
You think the television cameras should be there? We should be seeing that toll come home?
Exactly. I believe that that is so important. And on top of that, those who are wounded, they have only come out of the shadows due to the fact that many who need the care have been mishandled, as in the example of, in Washington.
Walter Reed,
et cetera. But that's not just that place. There are many wounded who are struggling just to even get into the VA line. It is 3 years behind in terms of, depending on your injury. Mental health is at the last, you know, those people who are mentally affected are at the end of the line. And then their families are never spoken about, and those are the primary caretakers.
Melita, you lost a stepson. Your husband lost a son. How do you now understand the meaning of his sacrifice as a Marine in Iraq?
Well, first of all, I do disagree with the fact that the word volunteer means that there are no incentives at all. My stepson signed up at 17 prior to 9/11 due to those incentives. And he went to boot camp and he was 17, okay? Mm-hmm. That was something that gave him a lot of pride, a lot of honor, because he could be independent and also help his family.
If we ask you what he died for in Iraq, what do you say?
He died because he grew up in a house where we believed in service. He would volunteer. He watched myself, my husband, his siblings volunteer prior to even discussing the military. This was something that we would do. As a matter of fact, my husband would say the words of John Kennedy, it's not what you can do, it's not what the country can do for you, but it's what you can do for this country.
And is that enough, that ideal of service, that he should die for that? Is it the ultimate? Is it not enough in this case?
I pray to God that, and I am deeply Catholic, that I will be with Alex again, and that it is. I think that his calling was higher, and perhaps through his death, it will give meaning towards ending this war. I think that's very important, that we need to realize that we need to invest in our troops and not just waste them. They are the best of the best, and they are much more important than the arms or the property or the oil.
Melita, we hope your prayers are answered, and we honor the sacrifice of Alex. Thank you for your call. Let me go to Hartford, Connecticut, and Scott. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, the issue that I want to put on the table has to do with, I have a daughter. She's in second grade. And, you know, today at our school, they had a Memorial Day program where the kids were up on stage singing songs and reciting poems and that sort of thing. On Monday, she's going to be marching, as, you know, millions of other children will be, in the Memorial Day parade. And the issue that I have is, you know, it's difficult enough for us adults to figure out what this all means. And I just wonder, you know, what it is. It's not that I don't think that we should honor, you know, our people who have served in the military. It's just, what does it mean to involve children in this? And how do we possibly make this make sense to them?
Richard Cohn, how do you respond to Scott? You've looked at military history. You've expressed your own unease about the very exercise of war. His second grade daughter will march in the memorial parade.
I think it can be interpreted to the youngsters as a matter of community participation and as a membership in a society. One of the things we forget is that traditionally in this country, military service and service to one's community is a part of citizenship. And you can't explain that really to a second grader. It's something that youngsters grow up with. We need to strengthen, I think, in this country, the teaching of civics and citizenship participation. But it can only be taught to them, I think, as part of the larger context of what it means to be a good human being living in society and in a community and to be an American in this United States.
But don't children want to know, what is it really for? Not just that I belong to something, but if people are going to die. We heard right at the top of the show, young man speaking of his brother's death and saying he died for freedom. He died for freedom. Jean?
Tom, may I weigh in on this? I think Richard's right that these rituals of citizenship are terribly important and that we've allowed many of these to wither on the vine. Bringing children in on Memorial Day, which is a day to remember, it's not a day to cheer for the Iraq War. It's a day to remember the sacrifice of soldiers. And look, children are very aware that these things are happening. I think of my own grandchildren and how they try to process the horror of 9/11. Children often feel very powerless when they hear adults speaking of things like Iraq or 9/11 and so forth. And there's a way that we need to involve them. And I think
but Scott's saying there's something, I hear him saying there's something gruesome also to introduce them to a ritual when we're not even sure what the war is about.
But the ritual has to do, again, with the theme of this program. The ritual has to do with all the soldiers that lie in all those cemeteries, both in the United States and abroad, who over many, many years now have answered the call to duty. And I think that gives children some sense of participation in the history of their country and in those sentiments that Jonathan talked about at the beginning, and that's entirely compatible, it seems to me, with hearing the adults in their particular environment arguing about the justice or not or wisdom or not of a particular war.
I guess I'm picking up on Scott's unease, and maybe I share it with brushing by the justice part too quickly, especially when it comes to children. Let me go to a caller, Steve in Newton, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
This past weekend, I attended the wake for Andy Bacevich, and it was very moving. It was very difficult. And for me, the word that kept resonating in my head was the word immoral, not having to do with what Bush and Cheney have done. I hope that someday they'll answer to a much higher authority for what they've done. But for the rest of us, who have let families like the Baseviches bear a special, I think for this war, a unique and an unconscionable burden for the war that is the war for all of us. My family, so many families that I've known have really paid no price. Taxpayers pay no price. I mean, we can go on and on in the special ways in this war that the rest of us citizenry are paying no price. And to me, it seems that there's only one word for it. It's immoral in a very special way.
What does that mean, then, about the sacrifice that Lieutenant Basevich made about the sacrifice that 3,000 and more and more and more have made now. In your mind, Steve?
To me, it's very different to see people who, in their own minds, I think very often have either misgivings or just plain disagreement with this war or the war they serve in. And this is not the first time it's happened. And yet, when the call to serve their country comes, they say yes voluntarily. And the rest of us turn away and say, well, it's someone else's war.
Tom, I think...
Yes, please.
I think Steve makes a very important point. But I would say that we are all going to pay for this war, and we are going to pay for it for at least one, perhaps two generations. The Basevichs, and I know Lieutenant Basevich's father, much worse, a cruel twist of fate, almost Shakespearean in magnitude, much worse than others. But we will all pay for this war. I'm not ready yet to put it in immoral terms, but I can certainly sympathize that many would.
Jonathan Schell, then, if you sit on Memorial Day to memorialize those who have died in this war, what's your sense of responsibility to these dead as we honor them, as everyone says it should be happening today, your sense of responsibility when it comes to their sacrifice?
Well, I'd like to make two comments. One is that as long as the country is sending soldiers out to die in wars, those soldiers should be remembered in ceremonies like Memorial Day. But I think there's some other people that we have to remember here, too. And this is certainly brought to the fore by the Iraq War. You know, hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq have died because of this war. Now, if this war was a flat-out mistake, as I believe it was, then those lives were surely wasted.
So and the soldiers were not wasted, but theirs were?
No, I said before, I think McCain and Obama were right when they used the word wasted, but it doesn't mean that they're, in the terms of their own existences and lives, that their sacrifices were in vain, because they had that readiness to sacrifice, which is always an admirable thing and has value. But they were wasted in the sense that they needn't have died because the war was a mistake. But there's just one other. So there ought to be some way that we remember those people in Iraq that have died in far greater numbers than our own people.
And our time is short. Your final thought, Jonathan.
My final thought is that what I really look forward to is a day when we memorialize some other way of sacrificing that does not involve war and killing. I second Mr. Cohn on this. And perhaps we have such a day, and that's Martin Luther King Day. After all, there was sacrifice there, but it did not involve war. It did not involve killing. And so maybe that day will be the day.
I want to thank you all for being with us this hour.
Thank
Jonathan
you.
Schell, Jean Bethke Elstein, and Richard Cohn, thanks to each of you. We go out with taps from the funeral of U.S. Navy Petty Officer Second Class Adam McSween, April 17th, York, Nebraska. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.